Have you ever wondered what it was like to do a higher degree research qualification, or why someone might consider doing one? In this podcast, we open up the world of doctoral research by delving into the stories behind the research, speaking to current CSU candidates as they navigate the trials and tribulations of their research journeys. Listen to the why, what, and how of these innovative researchers, as well as what spurred them on to pursue this research pathway. This is Stories Behind the Research on the CSU Research Hub and 2MCE FM.
I'm Dawn Tukenew from the Researcher Development Team at Charles Sturt University. Today, I'm with our guest, Amy Proudford-Nolder. She is the part-time PhD candidate in the School of Social Work and Arts. Amy's research title is The Law in English Literature, The Pediology of Legal Context and Advancing Gender Equality in the Teaching of Secondary English in the 21st Century. Her bio reads, Amy Proudford-Nolder is a secondary school teacher working in Orange, New South Wales. She was originally a litigation lawyer, but moved into education a decade ago when her young family started school. She is the mother of three busy children, and with her husband and kids, she helps to run a small cattle farm and care for a menagerie of pets. Her passions are English literature, theatre, music, and motorsport, as well as writing her PhD in law and literature. Welcome, Amy, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Dawn.
So I'm really looking forward to hearing about yourself and your research and your journey so far, and also to share your story with our listeners. But before we hear all about your research, I've just read out the bio that you sent me before our interview. You're quite the busy lady.
I am. I was actually thinking that when you were reading it out. It sounds a bit chaotic, actually.
I am, yes. You are. And what prompted you to move from the legal world to the education one?
Yeah, it was a long path. I absolutely loved law at school and loved being a lawyer. And I practiced for many years down in Sydney. And I think down in Sydney, it was a very exciting, it was a great life for someone who was single. But I had the absolute yearning to come back to the country and have a farm and raise a family and have lots of pets. And I think when I got back to the country and had kids, I just realised the two lifestyles were difficult for me. I know lots of people do manage it, but I just I was struggling to manage it. And I thought education had always been something I'd been really interested in. It was actually what I put down first when I did my HSC uni choices. So I thought, oh, I might just embrace that and see what that's like. And I didn't ever look back. I studied part-time while I was on maternity leave with my third baby and just got into teaching, and I've found my passion. I absolutely love it. So it's been a great journey, but I think I've found where I'm meant to be now.
That's great. Now, you mentioned pets. I consider myself to have a fair number of pets. Tell me about yours.
I think I'm known as the crazy lady up the road. Mm-hmm. We have 9 dogs that all live in the house. We have 2 cats. I've got a horse, an alpaca, pet sheep, pet cockatoos. My son's got turtles. My daughter has camels. It's crazy. We have a bit of everything. I've got miniature donkeys. I think you could pretty much name a pet and we've got it.
Wow. Well, yes, you have definitely one up on me, that's for sure. And you mentioned you've got 3 children. How old are they?
So I've got 2 boys and 1 girl. So my boys are 14 and 11 and my daughter's 12.
Good ages, busy ages.
Yeah, and all very busy, all with their own passions and pursuits. And, yeah, it's lovely seeing them grow up and follow their dreams.
That's great. Now, you write your passions are English literature, theatre, music, which for me, I can see the relationship. But then you throw in motorsport. How does that fit in?
That mainly fits in. I was always just like to watch the races a little bit, but my eldest son from the age of about 10 months just became obsessed with anything with wheels. I could only get him to eat his dinner if he was watching Rory the racing car on TV while he ate. And he's pursued that through go-karting. So he's actually 14 years old now and just getting into racing cars. And he's off to the UK in a couple of months' time to go for a scholarship to race in the UK next year. So he's well and truly in the world of motorsport. So I find myself going from a dance concert or a music concert with other kids to the racetrack and watching him online, and it's fabulous.
What a great contrast.
It is a wonderful contrast.
So moving on to your research, and I'm sure this question may relate to your teaching, I'm wondering what or maybe who inspired you to pursue a higher degree by research?
Yeah, funny. I just got it into my head in my early 20s that I really wanted to do a PhD. It just became something very personal for me. And I used to talk with my mum about doing it, and we used to sort of joke about when I get my PhD and what I'll do my PhD in. So it was always a very personal goal that I wanted to achieve myself. And I think I'd spent a lot of time looking for a research topic. I'd been told if you're going to do your PhD, make sure you do something in, you know, that you love, that you can really stick with. It's a long haul. You don't want to get bored with it after a little while. You want to really love it. So I was searching. I'd had a whole lot of different ideas, but they were either something that would go out of vogue quite quickly or something that I didn't really feel passionate about. My mum always told me, if you're going through a dark time or a hard time, read, just escape. So if I ever had a breakup or anything like that, she'd say, just get into your books and read. And after she passed away, I was obviously struggling badly, and I followed her advice. I read and I read and I read. You know, I like to believe there's a hidden message somewhere, because literally the books that I read in the order that I read them gave me the topic for my thesis. So as I read them, I thought, these are wonderful books, and, you know, I can see why they're historically renowned, but there's a different story here. There's a law at play in this novel or underlying the plot that is really relevant today that we really should unpack and have a look at in the modern context. And literally I read a fairy tale, a book about the mother of fairy tales, and then I read a Jane Austen novel, and then I read a Virginia Woolf novel. And in those orders, I saw these laws at play, and that's where the thesis was born.
You could say that your mum guided you.
Absolutely. So it's a lovely, lovely story. She's still right there with me.
That is beautiful. And so can you explain what your research topic is for our listeners?
It's a long title, as you were reading it earlier. I think in simpler terms, what I'm looking at doing is, there is a debate at the moment in English teaching about the place of the literary canon or classical texts, and whether we should move on and look at modern texts, diverse texts from diverse authors and you know, different new stories, or whether we should be sticking with classics that, you know, many of us read at school and many of us know. And I feel very much in the middle. I think we absolutely have to embrace new literature and hear new stories from diverse backgrounds. All the stories we can embrace and learn other perspectives is fabulous. But I still believe there's a very strong place for the literary canon in teaching, for that very reason, that there are laws at play in the plots of these stories that really give an insight into what it was like, particularly to be a woman back in the 17th and 18th centuries, particularly, that still are highly relevant today. And if we keep looking at those classic texts, we get a whole lot of benefits. We get the canonical literature, we get the textual integrity, we get the characters and the storylines that have stood the test of time. We learn about that particular historical era, but most importantly, we can unpack those laws that significantly impacted the women in the plot lines, and we can see how they resonate and relate to young women's lives today. And from that, that's a stepping stone into, well, what about other people suffering from discrimination or exclusion in society? What can we learn from these stories that might help us be more empathetic today? So it's really, the whole thesis is about, as an English teacher, how can we take those canonical texts and teach them in new, exciting, engaging ways that will really engage young modern students and let them see the interesting, engaging part of the story and learn all those other important aspects at the same time.
So in that last sentence, and correct me if I'm wrong, so the legal context and the gender equality, how are they fitting in with what you've just said?
I think the legal context, when you have a look at, well, let's say, for example, I'm looking at Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. Today, you know, a lot of people refer to it as a bonnet drama. And, you know, there's lots of modern adaptations and fan fiction, and it's a lot of it is about Mr. Darcy and Elizabeth. But when you really drill down into the plot line and you understand Jane Austen's personal and historical context, it's not a story about falling in love with Mr. Darcy. It's a story about five sisters who were at the mercy of the law of entail in England at the time, which meant that they obviously couldn't inherit because they were women. The property had to go to the nearest male relative, and nor could they go out and earn their own income. Jane Austen earned a little bit in her lifetime as a writer, but she was certainly an anomaly. So it's really a story about women who were at the mercy of the law of entail and the laws of inheritance at the time, who, if they didn't marry well, became a burden on their family or were pretty much stuck in the poorhouse. So I think if we look at that idea of the law at play underneath the plot, the impact that that law had on the women, and then we teach it in a modern classroom, we can say, well, modern women today, certainly we're not impacted by inheritance laws, but we're still fighting for equal pay. And there are still a lot of social issues around gender inequality that we can make a connection between the text and why it was so relevant then and why it still remains relevant today.
You're listening to Stories Behind the Research on the CSU Research Hub.
So why do you believe this research is important?
I think we are at a point where the education system is open to new ideas and we desperately need new ideas. Literacy across the world is falling. The latest PISA studies in Australia indicate we do have a literacy crisis happening. Interestingly, in the past few years, it's been mostly girls where literacy has been declining more rapidly. So whilst we see literacy falling with boys and girls, it's happening quicker with girls. And I think that's something that we're all very aware we need to stop and address quickly. But I also, as a teacher, I think it's so important that when you walk into a classroom, you bring joy and you bring engagement and you bring enthusiasm. Students are amazingly perceptive. They know if you're not interested or you're not keen. So a teacher who is really enthusiastic and really engaged and they know their topic back to front, that's when students are really involved and they come with you on that learning journey. So I think it's really important that as educators, we find new ways of making reading and literacy joyful and engaging and interesting and relevant to real life, something that students can connect with, because we really do have to get students reading again, and they won't read if they're not interested and they aren't presented with texts that they find interesting.
Yes, or even finding the stories within the stories get all interesting and more real.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Yes. Having a couple of teenagers myself, I totally understand what you're saying in regard to getting them engaged.
Yeah. Well, I think another springboard for my research was I did have a class with beautiful year 10 students, a lovely class. And each year the students can pick a particular genre that they want to study for a term. And I luckily had the classics genre. So I had a room of about 15 year 10 students and they were all diligently reading their classics. We had some students reading Pride and Prejudice and some reading Great Expectations and some reading The Great Gatsby. But the room this day was just very numb. There was very little engagement or enjoyment in the room. Everyone was just sort of going through the motions of reading. And just as an impromptu, I said, okay, let's just stop and look at the laws that were happening in these books. And I went around and we did the laws of entail and we did the prohibition laws and the workhouse poor laws. And immediately I had these kids just so enthralled. One boy sort of slammed his hand on the table and said, this is wrong. This shouldn't happen. And the girls were saying, if this was me today, I wouldn't be able to inherit the farm. I couldn't have my own agency. And in that moment, I saw the true essence of education. You know, these students were learning, they were engaged, they were so fired up about what we were learning. And I thought, that's what we have to access. Students will actually read and they'll remember these texts and they'll debate these texts with friends and they'll write about these texts with passion because we've accessed what it is that really engages them.
And how long ago was it that you had that experience in the classroom?
That was 2021 that I had that experience. So just before I started, and that was really something that made me think, yeah, this is an idea for a lesson.
And I'm guessing that's something that you bring into the classroom often now?
Absolutely. I'm just so devoted to the idea that if the teacher isn't passionate, if the teacher isn't engaged, and if the teacher isn't loving what they do, the students aren't going to find it interesting and engaging either. You know, it is a relationship between teacher and learner. If they don't see that you want them to learn and there's something to be curious about, they won't participate as well.
So what would be the difference if you only focused on historical literature in the classroom, even with enthusiasm, but didn't relate it to modern day things? What would be the impact of that?
Yeah, well, I think all humans are the same, aren't we? If we see something on the news that has no relevance to us, or if we hear something that's completely out of our experience, it's hard to relate and it's hard to make those connections. I think if I taught Pride and Prejudice and I was just looking at the literary techniques, or I was just looking at the form, or I was just looking at the characterization, it's so removed. You know, it's such a different era. The values are so different. The characters, they speak differently. They talk about clothing that people have no idea what that means anymore. It's, you can't access it, can you? But if somehow the character is just like you in a different context, but maybe restricted in a slightly different way, but still restricted as you may feel restricted in your life, there's that connection. You suddenly have some resonance and you can tap into that character and empathize with how they might be feeling and what you might do in that situation.
So what is already known about your research topic?
Well, I think what the main sort of academic area that I'm tapping into, it's called the law and literature movement. It's a very big academic movement in tertiary circles in America, a little bit in Australia, but mostly in America. Richard Weisberg is a well-known figure in the law and literature movement, but it's really very much confined, as I say, to academic conferences and to law schools. And it's really looking at teaching prospective lawyers in law schools about the importance of literature and how when we read literature, we get to know the characters and the situations and tap into that empathy and learn so much about how the law impacts real people. So whilst there's a lot known about that movement, there's very little practical application in secondary school settings. So that's really my niche, and what's new about my research is taking that academic idea and actually giving it some practical purpose in terms of modernising and progressing secondary teaching in Australia.
That's excellent. So when did you actually begin your research?
I began July 21, actually studying with my supervisors. So I'm about 40,000 words in so far, progressing nicely. I'd obviously like to be able to go faster. It would be lovely to do it full time and be able to just focus solely on the thesis, but part-time it works. It's coming along. So it's just, I've come to the realization over the Christmas holidays that have just gone past, I realize don't rush it, you know, don't have a deadline and think you've got to make this deadline. And, you know, obviously you do have deadlines that you have to meet, but enjoy the process. If it takes 6 months longer than I thought it would, and I've enjoyed it and I've taken the time to really delve into the research I want to delve into, then that's far better outcome.
And so what have your discoveries been along the way?
Amazing stories. I think the first chapter I'm doing was looking at the fairy tale genre, and I knew the main parts of it, which is why I wanted to research it. I've just finished this chapter and it's about a lady called Madame d'Aulnoy. She lived in the 1600s, the late 1600s, and she is known as the mother of fairy tales. She was actually the first person to write a literary fairy tale in the salons of Paris. And even though when we think of fairy tales now, we think of Charles Perrault or we think of the Brothers Grimm, it's Madame d'Aulnoy who actually started the whole literary genre. And when you delve into her life, she was married off at 13 to a much older man who was a gambler, a drinker, not a nice character at all. And a few years later, the marriage must have been bad enough because this Madame d'Aulnoy and her mother conspired to have her husband murdered for treason. He managed to convince the king that he hadn't spoken treason and he was let off and she was actually imprisoned with her little baby daughter. And for the next 13 years or so, both her husband and King Louis XIV had her imprisoned for her bad behaviour. Wow. And so while she was in the nunnery in the convent where she was imprisoned, she wrote all of these stories. She was very clever in that she framed her fairy tales within quite respectable classical novels and literature. But the fairy tales themselves were incredibly subversive feminist texts. So there were no damsels in distress. They were quite Amazonian, fierce, independent fairies and princesses and women of the aristocracy who were somehow mistreated, but usually through their own determination and their own sense of loyalty and very strong values and virtue, they got themselves rescued. And the whole way through, they kept their wit. They were very funny stories. These are really incredible, brave women with a great sense of humour who sort things out for themselves. And it's just so interesting to see how when you read the fairy tales, knowing that context, a woman who's imprisoned, it's usually because of society's laws and social norms around women doing what men tell them, but they work things out for themselves and they subvert the norms and they get around things and they end up victorious. And knowing that context, you can see exactly what she's saying about the court of King Louis XIV and about Parisian society in general and how things need to change. But she was clever enough to frame them within respectable stories. And in that way, she basically told the whole salon community that you can use accepted literature to make great social change. So looking at the laws of marriage and the laws of inheritance and the actual situation she was in when she wrote these fairy tales and the subsequent, I suppose, erasure of her work. We don't know her name very well anymore because she was a woman and she was defiant and she subverted accepted laws. It's the men we now associate with fairy tales.
That's so true. Did you deliberately seek out those stories or did you fall across them?
Yes, I really fell across them. I mean, I've learned that sometimes you've just got to let your research go the way it's going to go. Those books, that as I read them, they literally came in the order that I'm reading them. And yeah, I found different ones along the way as well. But just wide reading and being passionate about literature, it's like the novels themselves just fell into place. And overall, I've learned really whatever classic text I pick up, there's so much more that we in the modern world we're missing. If we look closely at the laws and the context, the social norms of the time, there's a big lesson for us in the modern world.
Have you had any surprises about what you've discovered?
The size of the law and literature movement and the fact that it isn't that well known in Australia, particularly in, you know, in secondary education, that's been quite a surprise. And I think the personal stories of all of the writers, that's what I've been enjoying the most. I laugh that there's PhD time. You can think that you just go and sit down for an hour and do a little bit of reading and suddenly you look out the window and it's dark and 7 hours have gone past and you haven't realised it. So it's the personal stories of the writers that I've found so interesting. The things that they had to deal with and the message that they were trying to convey. Often, like with the fairy tales, she couldn't say what she wanted to say or she would have had an appointment with the guillotine. Yes. And Jane Austen couldn't really say what she wanted to say because it wasn't socially acceptable. So you can tell from a modern perspective, you can tell what these writers are trying to say to us across the centuries. And it's just fascinating going back.
It is incredible. And your ability to be able to see that and pick that and see those patterns and read between the lines.
It's awesome. It's great fun.
You're listening to Stories Behind the Research on the CSU Research Hub.
So what about challenges along the way? What have you needed to overcome in your research journey?
Not too many. I found my supervisors were really supportive. You know, when you get online with CSU, everything's set out for you. So it's been quite, I wouldn't say easy. You know, it's very time consuming and lots of thought processes. But in terms of the admin, getting in and getting started has been really great. I've had a wonderful mentor. Sharon's been helping me as well in the first few steps. So that's all been really good. I think in terms of challenge, for me, it's time, you know, being a full-time teacher, mum of three, you really do have to keep your writing and your research to holiday time, school holidays, which I'm really lucky that I have. I'd obviously, you want to sit down and you just want to finish that chapter or finish that article and you can't, there's just no time. So that's been really challenging. And I think part of that was coming to that realization of just slow down, stop, enjoy the process. It's not necessarily about racing to the finish line. Just enjoy it while you do it. And I think in terms of my last chapter, it was not being fluent in French. That was really challenging. So I had to rely on a few people to help me read out French texts that hadn't been translated. So if I could go back and speak to my 12-year-old self, I would say learn French.
Have you picked up much French along the way? I've got to ask you.
Yeah, enough to sort of see a word and know what it means, but I can't pronounce it properly or read a whole text. So it's been good in that sense, but a bit of a shame that I didn't think to learn French when I was younger.
Oh, yes. Well, that's a nice surprise anyway to come out of it.
Absolutely.
And so what do you hope to achieve with your research?
As I say, it's been a really personal journey. So the day, I don't know what I'll do with the day I get my PhD. I think I'll burst into tears and be quite embarrassing. It's going to be really, really rewarding when that finally happens. I would love to possibly write a book out of my research and possibly lecture one day about my findings and how, or do a talk series where I go around and help schools to implement the actual program and put it into place in schools. Very open to wherever my research might lead, but I certainly don't want to just finish it and leave it there. I'd like to take it and just whatever it can do to help engage young students in English literature and in literacy in general.
I think it's so important. And hopefully your ideas will get adopted by these various schools. And if they were, or even if it went further, I mean, I know they keep talking about these education reforms and how things need to change. I know that they're still teaching the same things that they taught when I was at school, which is a few years ago now. This research, how could it really impact all the schools or the education system as a whole if it was to go that far? Amy.
I think I'm asking educators to look just from a different angle. I'm not trying to rewrite programs or curriculum or anything like that. I'm just saying, let's be open-minded. Let's look at different angles and let's actually put these into practice in the classroom because they do work. You know, I have been at when I've done lessons based on, you know, really delving into context and, you know, particularly in respect of the laws, it does engage young people. They really do find that very interesting. And if you can then say, you know, okay, this part of society in this text were excluded or didn't have a voice, you know, Jim in Huckleberry Finn didn't have a voice. He was completely excluded. How do you think people in the modern world feel, like refugees or immigrants, if they don't have a voice? How do you think they feel? We're really making education realistic and connected to the real world. And that's what young people want. They don't want to be just, you know, technique driven or having to memorize a list of quotes or something. They want to actually intellectually engage with what's happening in the world. So I think the impact I would like to see is that these new ideas are coming through and being embraced, and we're trying out different ideas to make students really, really gain a lot from their education rather than just going through the motions.
I think that makes a whole heap of perfect sense.
Excellent. That's a good start.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, who doesn't want to be engaged in their own education? Who would rather be going through the motions, studying these things, but making it relevant and making it passionate and making it, you know, make a whole heap of sense rather than just being bored, as my son would say.
Yeah, well, that's right. And it works both ways. You know, it's awful as a teacher to see a class bored. You know, if you have a lively debate going on or you have students really asking questions and wanting more information, it's so much fulfilling for the teacher as well. So yeah, I think it is time. I think it's, you know, the modern age, we've got to look from different angles and different perspectives and really listen to what students want, you know, in terms of still doing the work and still learning a lot and writing and doing all the things that literacy requires. Yeah, letting them enjoy it. You've got to find the joy in learning, don't you?
Absolutely. So I want to take you back just a little bit, and you talked about the struggles and the juggles of all your life and doing research. How do you manage life, or how have you been managing life through this period?
Good question. I think I go through different phases of my research. If I'm really actively, you know, I really want to finish this series of articles or something, I get up very early. So I get up at 5 a.m. and just do a little bit of research and then start the school lunch and feeding animal routine. Sometimes I can fit some in at night after I get home from work and I've done all my marking and things. But really, I think it's just been having a supportive family is amazing. You know, my husband understands that this is really important to me. So he helps, you know, hang the washing on the line or something if I'm reading for the day. And my kids are wonderful. They're really interested and really engaged, and they ask me how it's going. And so they're really supportive as well. But mostly, as I say, it's school holidays. So luckily the kids are old enough now where they might be on their racing simulator or doing some dance practice or music practice or out in the pool, and I can just sit by the pool and read articles, or I can be in the house with them while they're doing their homework and I can do some research. So you really just have to pick your times, grab opportunities when they present themselves, and just be okay with yourself. You know, don't beat yourself up if you're a little bit behind in the schedule. You know, you can make it up, and just really value the education. That's all part and parcel of the process.
There's a real art in that balance and containing, I guess, elements of frustration, because, I mean, the passion for your research is coming through so clear. I can imagine sitting there and just getting so enthralled with reading, and that time is escaping you without you even noticing. And all of a sudden you've got to put it down because you've got to take a child to practice, and you'd be so reluctant to be able to do that. But yeah, so that would be tough.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, I think we all have those moments, don't we? But yeah, just seeing the big picture, and it's all going to happen. It's all going to come together. But just, yeah, I think also don't rush the childhoods, and don't rush the joy of every day yourself. So just trying to take it all as it comes and enjoy it. But I do feel those moments of frustration and wanting to just have a day of reading and writing, but you have to go to work or you have to go and do something else. So yeah, I think that's the pain and the pleasure of research, isn't it?
It is. And I think you're modeling such good, you know, everything, good behaviors, good thinking, good processes, everything for the kids. So I think that's great.
Oh, thank you.
And so it sounds like the family are involved in this? Is this like a dinner table conversation, your research?
A little bit. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it's just, on a Sunday afternoon, I might say, "Oh, I'm going in to do my PhD for a bit," and they'll say, "All right, how many more words of this chapter have you got?" Or, "Did you find that article you were looking for last night?" I think the kids are at a lovely age that we can talk about it. I think a couple of years ago, we went over to England and I got to take the kids all around Jane Austen country. And I think my kids got a little bit too much of Jane Austen at that point. They really didn't want to see that Jane Austen once sat down and had a cup of tea on that rock. They had a lot of laughs about mum dragging them around to every place that Jane Austen ever took breath in. So sometimes I can overdo it a little bit. But I think it's really good in that in the car we can talk about, the fairy tales, for example, and where they came from and Jane Austen. And, sometimes my kids will surprise their teacher with how much they might know about a particular writer, and they kind of roll their eyes and say, "Yeah, mum." But I think it's lovely. You just mentioned that sort of role model. I think it's really good to see that, my kids see that mum's got homework too, and mum loves some of her work and some of it's a bit dreary, but that's just life. And you get on and but you enjoy your learning. I think that's the biggest message I can probably pass on, is that curiosity is a fabulous thing and hard work hopefully pays off.
I love that, Amy. I think curiosity is my favorite word of all time.
Yeah, it's a great word, isn't
It
it? Keeps you
is.
going.
It does. Are there any key lessons or things that you've learned about yourself over this time?
I think something I knew that once I decide to do something, I will do it. Even if it's hard or it doesn't happen as fast as I want to, I definitely will do it. I think it's just been a really, it's been a great process. It can be very lonely, can't it, doing research on your own? But that can also be that quiet time that you might actually really need at times. And I think just having that courage, I think I was saying to you last time we chatted, I was really nervous starting the research. I had that imposter syndrome, how can I do a PhD? What if I don't write well enough? Or what if I don't know what to do? Or, all of those thoughts came through my head. So yeah, I had to have that moment of just write what is happening and rely on your supervisors to help you. And I got over that pretty quickly. That was a bit of a scary thing at first. Can I actually do this? So it's been nice to learn that yes, I can do it. It's scary, but just get on with it and see how you go, and I will get there.
And that imposter is syndrome is so common.
Is it?
It comes up in so many conversations.
That's right. I think you have an image of, what you want your PhD to be, or what it should look like. And when you actually sit down and start typing, you think, "Oh, okay, this is actually happening."
That's the big wow moment.
That's right. Yeah.
So if you could go back, would there be anything that you change in the journey so far?
I don't think so. No, I've been really happy and really, really content, I think, with the process so far. Of course, I would have loved to have done it when I was a bit younger, but maybe I wouldn't have had all that experience and that teaching knowledge to bring to it. So no, I think I've found really supportive supervisors, a great mentor. It's working with my life as it is at the moment. So it's, yeah, I'm really enjoying it.
So the stage that you're at now, like how long do you anticipate you've got left?
Yeah, I'm hoping I'll get it done within the next 18 months. That's the hope.
Great.
But yeah, not too sure. It might happen sooner, it might take a little bit longer, but definitely that's my goal, is to have it wrapped up pretty much end of 25 or halfway through 26.
So if one of our listeners or a few of our listeners are thinking, maybe I could do research, what would your advice be to them?
It's been really interesting. I've had a few colleagues approach me and sort of say, "I've always thought about it, and you're actually doing it. I might do it too." So that is an actual phenomenon where people think that. I would say to them, go for it. Even if you're working full time, the university's great and giving you a long time to get it done. And even if you have to change your research a little bit, or circumstances change, or whatever, I think just start. Just back yourself and absolutely go for it. It has been the most rewarding educational experience I've ever had. I think because it's my baby, I'm not just doing the same course as everybody else and writing the same essay. I'm the only person doing this particular research. So you feel very sort of protective and proud of your research, even when it's not going the way you want it to. It's yours. So it's a wonderful experience. And yeah, it's draining and everything, but I think as my dad said, you're going to be the same age when you graduate as you will be if you don't graduate. So just do it. You'll have a PhD. So I think if you're considering it, I would say find something you're really passionate about and you've really always wanted to know about and you're going to love, because it is a big mind space that it's going to take, and you're going to wake up in the middle of the night with new ideas and thoughts and that you have to jot down really quickly. So be passionate about it, but don't doubt yourself. Just get into it and accept help. There's so much help. People are really willing to help and advise you and guide you in a nice way. So just go for it.
And sleep with a notepad next to your bed.
Absolutely. And a torch.
Well, I love your dad's advice there too. That really puts things into perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to do something, just go and do it. Just that idea of the joy of learning. You know, obviously as a teacher, I'm trying to project that, but just really as an adult, you know, we don't have to just work and earn an income and, you know, mow the lawns and do the washing. It is okay to keep experiencing the joy of learning. I think that's a really key message. And I've also been told by my kids that I have to give them a shout out. So I have to say hello to George and Jeanette and James.
That's gorgeous. Hi, guys.
I don't have to. I want to, because they're very, very cool people.
They sure sound like it.
They are.
Just a curious question, Amy. If people wanted to learn more about your research, do you have like a blog or a LinkedIn profile or any way that people can find out about what you're doing?
I have to get better at that. I do have a LinkedIn profile, but I haven't got a blog or anything like that up and running. So I'm just getting to the stage now where I'm confident enough to start applying to do some research, conference papers and things like that, like present my research so far to conferences. That's on the cards, to get a blog or some sort of web page up so people can follow what I'm doing.
Well, that'll be for something for us to look into sometime in the future.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Amy, and to all our listeners for tuning in. Congratulations on getting so far. And I, for one, am very excited about the changes that you could influence in the classroom. I hope that writing up the rest of your thesis continues to be smooth sailing and with plenty of rewards. Thanks for sharing some of your personal journey too. It's always so interesting for me, and I think for other people, to hear about you and the journey that and the influences and impacts that your research has had on you.
Thank you. It's been lovely chatting.
It has been. And I'm hearing that a lot of people, I think, will be inspired by your story and the juggles and struggles and things that you've deal with and overcome to pursue your dream. I think it's quite admirable and definitely inspiring. So thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
All right. So for our listeners, thanks for joining us. And if you have a research story to share or know someone who does, we'd love to hear from you. Please reach out to us at email researcherdevelopment@csu.edu.au. We'll catch you on our next episode. Until then, stay curious, keep exploring, and continue to make a difference in the world.
Thank you for tuning in to Stories Behind the Research. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. To learn more about higher degree pathways, visit research@csu.edu.au. If you have a story to share and would like to be featured on our podcast, email us at researcherdevelopment@csu.edu.au.